The northwest Donegal Gaeltacht parish of Gweedore is today known to many strangers as the cultural cradle of international music stars like Enya, Clannad and Alton. Before the Victorian era, it's unlikely that many beyond Donegal would have recognised the name of Gweedore. But that was to change when a booklet by an improving landlord, Lord George Hill, called Facts from Gweedore, caught the imagination of many leading Victorian politicians, writers and administrators who were then turning their attention to problems in Ireland. In April 1846, Sir Robert Peel took it on himself to praise Facts from Gweedore in the House of Commons.
I need only remind you of the improvements effected in Ireland by Lord George Hill. Is it true that only in the year 1838 that nobleman purchased some 18,000 or 20,000 acres of land in the wildest part of Ireland? That he said to himself, I will perform my duty as a landlord. I will persevere against all difficulties. I will not be deterred by any opposition I may encounter from my tenants or neighbours, but I will persevere in my attempt to improve the condition of the people. Is it true that that noble lord had succeeded in his attempt? Has he not succeeded without the advantage of those prejudices which ancient hereditary descent might have created in his favour? Is it true that by perseverance, by forbearance, by deference in the first instance perhaps to the ignorance or prejudices of the people, by kindly feeling and by evincing determination to effect improvements, he has effected the revolution he contemplated in the country? And has not this been done consistently and with the promotion of his own interests? Has not the value of his property improved? Have not his rentals increased? I must say I think that gentleman, by the example he has set, has entitled himself to be regarded as a public benefactor to his country.
While there's much to praise in the work Hill carried out in Gweedore, there was more to Gweedore than met his eye. While the document is fascinating and important in its own right, new readings of it are leading to a reassessment of Lord George Hill and the basis for his Facts from Gweedore. The interplay between environment, economy, society and culture are drawn together in the work carried out by Dr. Kevin Whelan in recent years. He's director of the Keo Notre Dame Centre in Dublin and feels that events in Gweedore are best understood when placed in a wider historical context.
I think if we're looking at what happened in Gweedore and indeed across the west of Ireland generally in the immediate post-famine period, that we have really to situate it in a much longer narrative, which is the narrative of what happened in Britain in general from the mid-18th century onwards. So in other words, I would see the famine clearances and the reorganisation of Rundale in the west of Ireland, I would see that as being the third phase of a kind of a triple movement. The first phase of which was the clearances in Scotland, the second phase of which was the enclosure movement in England, and then the Irish experience becomes the third phase. And in all three of those cases, what happened really was that the state dispossessed and removed the rights and privileges of the poor in favour of the kind of landed class. And they did that with the backing of the military power in Scotland, with the backing of kind of legislation in England and in Ireland. But in all three countries, in Scotland, in England and in Ireland, basically the rights and privileges of the poor were taken from them in relation to landowning by the state. In the name, of course, and this is where Lord George Hill's experiment is very interesting, in the name of progress and civilization, that these people had to be taken by the scruff of their neck for their own good, of course, the land taken from them, and they had to be introduced to a more rational, civilized form of modern agriculture.
Professor Donal O'Beale is head of the Irish Department in Queen's University, Belfast. A native of Gweedore, he's also editor of Scallan, the excellent local history magazine produced by Cumann Staire Agusanachais Gweedore. He offers a local perspective on the development of Gweedore up to and after the publication of Lord George Hill's Facts from Gweedore.
Bina dini ne bogo bagan ní an aige ví líige bhrúach na fáige ó chean ceanga de bhir fád ag an amsin ví de bugu maitha sin a ré mar ví a fásmachtar a talúgus agus tím na a hánig Lord George Hill an seo go sé de bugu hat fan amsin mar mácinn tú ar na léirscana tarniu agus arna sarvéan á rinne agus mar sin de tefaú gur bú si de líige léras brúach na fáige. Suasrá aitte ru a déanna bailí a siúláth agus mar sin do. Bhí na bailí líige gáis na farige, tá sé dom go fáil agus mar sin na bhíisiad ach tar réidir chéile bh siad agus na a tháinig sé sin an sin go dtíí an áit bhí an dúnre néhile méid chuid bhaid níar ó mór an daine an céad bhí an rahisin a chuisiad a líre go mór agus sin in fáátáthe chu na tíanana talh Simpson á a chéadúir mar go go leor daoine an le cíí ar bhartha.
I talked to Donald O'Boyle by the harbour at Bonbeg, probably the most concentrated example of Lord George's building programme. Just up the hill is Bonbeg Church of Ireland Church, with its commemorative plaque to Lord George Hill and his efforts to civilise Gweedore and to raise its people to a higher social and moral level.
You must remember that 400 years ago or so, there was hardly anyone living here. Those that were lived on the seashore or where they had access to water and to the shore and so on. But by the 1850s or thereabouts, they had increased hugely in number, and that brought its own problems. They were anti-landlords, anti-anybody who came in. You must remember before 1840s they didn't pay any rent, they didn't pay any money to anybody. Then suddenly all these landlords appeared. Quite a number of them, maybe 10, 15 of them in Gweedore or Clonmacnoise all together. It's very difficult to evaluate exactly how good or how bad George Hill really was, because the way the ordinary people saw him was somebody who imposed rents and more rents on them. Somebody else might see him as somebody who was doing his best to bring in innovations, but they didn't see it that way. And that always has been the conflict in Ireland, this conflict between an older culture and maybe new ways of doing things.
The environmental advantages of the old Rundale system were little understood by outsiders like Lord George Hill. That's the view of cultural geographer John Call. He's now working in development in the west of Ireland, but his earlier researches unearthed much of the science and sociology which underpinned that much maligned Rundale system in his native Gweedore. He took me to one of the cluster settlements by the Gweedore shoreline, which dates back to the period before the landlord's imprint was left on the landscape. Standing down on the coastal plain at Maharagachlan, you can look up at the rugged and spectacular beauty of this unique landscape. Dominated by the majestic quartzite cone of Mount Errigal and the Derryvay Mountains, the blanket bog sweeps towards the sandy plains and harbours, carrying your gaze towards the offshore islands. By far the most remarkable feature is the density and layout of the houses, sprinkled like an 8-mile-long necklace along the edge of the vast bogland. Even today, reading the landscape of Gweedore needs many levels of local knowledge.
From someone who hadn't been brought up in the system of living, it would have been seen as being very backward, and the landlord would have looked at them as being barbaric, insofar as that they had a system, for example, where we're standing at the moment at Maharagachlan, that we actually had byre dwellings where the cattle were actually kept in the house. And it was, again, advanced thinking insofar as it was a system of heating, which was way before its time as well, in terms of how do you... It was a pre-runner to central heating of types, you know. But, you know, he would have looked at that as being backward and being whatever, and that, again, that the houses should... The landlord view would be the houses should be whitewashed, and that they shouldn't be sort of in the way that they were, that they should look better, and that's sort of the visual aspect of it. Whereas the clustered settlements were where I suppose, again, I think the landlord might have missed the point that they were laid out in a specific way. Even you'll see at the house we're standing beside here, that the ruins of these houses, that there's a facing door, a double door, where you actually have a door that you can open one side or the other, depending on the wind direction. So again, they were very kind of energy conscious, you might say, as well, and how to deal with the landscape. And you also see that the alignment of the houses was always in relation to the prevailing wind as well. So I think there was a lot of science associated with the Rundale system, which maybe would have been lost on the landlord, because he'd be just looking at the visual side of it. And he would have looked, I suppose, in terms of the system was very much a barter economy. So therefore, I suppose what you had was a move to a commercial economy and to individual sort of farms, and moving towards a more commercial setup. And that in itself, I suppose, must have been a big change for the people. I mean, it's a bit like the move from communism to capitalism.
The mountain communities were extremely important. And what happened in the 18th century was essentially that those rights of the poor to access the common lands, which from time immemorial had been there and which weren't in private ownership, that those rights were taken from them, and these lands were then transferred into private ownership. So that when George Hill comes into Gidor, one of the first things that he wants to insist on is that the commonages are transferred into his private ownership, and that they're made available for large-scale sheep farming, which of course completely disrupted the environmental balance which was there in the earlier system, where the relationship between the commonages and the little kind of potato and oats crops, the commonage was extremely important because it allowed people to graze cattle, and that in turn created manure, which was the really significant feature in terms of maintaining the fertility of the infield. So once you deprive people of access to common land, you also deprive them, in fact, of the possibilities of properly rearing or raising their little crops of potatoes and oats as well. And the traditional systems, whether in England, in Ireland, or in Scotland, those traditional systems were rooted in what we would now call, I suppose, sustainability, in the idea that you had to be able to maintain fertility from year to year. And there was a very complex web of custom and tradition about how that was managed. All of that was a very sophisticated and hard-won kind of wisdom, which came from, you know, centuries of living in what is, after all, a tremendously harsh environment. And suddenly now you get, you know, people like Lord George Hill coming in. They are experts. They're based on a kind of a scientific interpretation of what should be a kind of a rational land use. But in some respects, those guys had no experience whatsoever of trying to live in the stern, rocky outposts of Gidor. But the local people had. But basically what you're getting is that old wisdom or inherited kind of accumulated environmental experience is just being cast aside as so much nonsense, so much rubbish, and that, as I say, these people have to be grabbed by the scruff of the neck and dragged, kicking and screaming, if necessary, for their own good, of course, into modernity, into rationality, into modern agriculture. And Lord George Hill never, I think, once in his life had any doubt but that he was doing a rational, civilised thing, and that he was a great benefactor of the people. But of course, the people themselves thought rather differently.
The landscape would have been very unique in terms of the Rundale system and its layout in Gidor. The system is an infield outfield system, so you had all of the houses were clustered in a clustered settlement, an agricultural cluster, and the agricultural system of Rundale meant that you then had an infield around that cluster of houses in which the crops were set, and it was laid out in a very organised sort of way, where the infield would not have been fenced off, but you would have had strips of land within the infield, which people owned a strip in various parts of the infield, so that you had a kind of a very equal and sort of egalitarian sort of way of dividing the land, so that people got a bit of bad land and a bit of good land and a bit of access to water and whatever. So it was a very fair system of land holding, and at its most organised, it was also very good insofar as that it was very environmentally friendly, insofar as that you had a lot system where actually you drew your pieces of land, and then there was a rotation system as well, so that you weren't stuck with the same strip forevermore. There was actually a rotation, and while that was organised and managed, it was a very efficient system, a very efficient way of working the type of land that you had in West Donegal. So then outside the of that, then you had the outfield, which was very much the grazing area. And then you had, as I said, the mountain landscapes here. And you would find that people moved with livestock for cattle between the outfield and the mountain. And also they would take cattle to the island as well. And I suppose as well as that, the environmental system was very advanced for the time, you might say. I mean, it was very advanced thinking in that they even had controls on the numbers of animals that could actually graze the landscape. So it was a kind of an environmental conservation going on then, which was, I suppose, far advanced on what we have today, insofar as that the system they had, they would call it talu bo or talu lebo, and it was sort of a cow's grass or a half cow's grass. It was a measure of land, and with it you had, I suppose, a corresponding number of sheep or animals that you could actually graze on that landscape. If you look at the science behind the way they worked the land, even in terms of the ridge system, the Humery, and you still see the relics, I suppose, of that in the landscape still in Gweedore and in other places in the west of Ireland. You know, the Humery, or as they call them in English, I think badly titled the lazy beds, because they're not that lazy when you start to do them, but very scientific process insofar as that it was using the poor quality land in the best way possible in terms of taking up the nutrients and building them up and making sure that you were getting the best out of the soil. And I think that a lot of that type of stuff might have been lost on him in terms of he was looking at creating his own sort of model society.
As Queen Victoria's reign began, Lord George Hill bought up half the parish of Gweedore from a number of absentee landlords, happy to get rid of their traditionally unprofitable holdings. For decades after the publication of Hill's book, Facts from Gweedore, was widely held to show reforming Irish landlordism at its best. Yet even as Facts from Gweedore was being regularly praised and republished over the next 50 years, Gweedore often grabbed international headlines for rural unrest and violent opposition to landlord-driven change and to those who try to enforce it. So how factual were the facts from Gweedore? Was Lord George exaggerating his achievements? Were his admirers deluded? Or was there something going on in Gweedore that they failed to note or understand?
There was a huge clash. I mean, he was trying to bring order where there was chaos, as he thought. To them it was not chaos, it was just something that had continued over a long period. They fought very hard against the landlord who tried to take over the mountain, take away most of their land, as they saw it. Had sheep brought over from Scotland, and had brought over shepherds in Scotland to take care of them and so on. And again, they were enemies, if you like, of culture and language, religion and so on. So I think that was the beginning of the conflict, change itself.
If you looked at some of the grants that he had, I suppose, in terms of helping people to fix up their houses and whitewash them, well, when you did that, you then paid more rent. So it's I suppose it was one way of achieving more rents in the place. I'd say he would have been very disappointed with the potential rents in the area when he was given this place or when it was bought for him. So it was a way of trying to increase income as well. And on the other hand, I think the positives that he did give were because they were moving into a kind of a market commercial society at the time. They did have to walk their produce, say to Dunloe or whatever, by horse, and then you were at the mercy of whatever price you got then, because you weren't going to walk back with it. So I think the system that was started in Wanvig with the store and the shop and fair weights and measures and the sign that still is there is Aurelish and Tiernadia and Mehan Falsa as Mylish and Mehan Cart or something like that. You know, weights and measures was, I suppose, giving better play, fair play to the locals in terms of what they got for their produce. But the best thing is to say it was like moving from communism to capitalism, and it was a big change for people.
A few years ago, Kathleen Nigilavridje, retired local schoolteacher, published another perspective on Lord George Hill and his period in Gwydor in Star Hanahus Gwydor. Maren na kifnishin gofoil.
Chos e clia agus crini na cri hart ar an eit agus ni roi cad ag dynir bi da wytr na tida agod cwiri hen elegin dysta. Yn ys hwys yr hiw lyhyd ta gairw bag gofoil ta se fasgol jenis agus ba ponta yn tredi a hogdir agus yn rodo fi on dynir bi as y chanter a wyhi a hwyt cwera ag ihe ar yn chroc. Chwyhi ysdas y ffont y sioi, agos fewch chi ysdi gynilw am dynnu pyn na fe ffyn. Nes ni roi'n sy'n na sian ffyn, a fi eisiau dacr gymau sian ffyn hen el, ced blian y hwn. Fi eit ylw ar yn tar, agos chai codon y cwyri hwrt yn sy'n gyd i'n ferig, mor tygw gyrdi na pes sas na hysda, agos yn syrfeig a di cwy yn tarig ydw'r sonna gyrra.
By shifting the economic system into what they would have seen as a more rational progressive form, you're also shifting the kind of culture or habits or character of the people into a more progressive form. So, like, in fact, you're rescuing them from barbarity and kind of archaic, outmoded, primitive practices. You're rescuing them then for modernity, rationality and progress. You know, and who can be against kind of progress, as it were? So, you know, the very use of the term improvement is a brilliant piece of PR in the 18th century. And, you know, somebody like George Hill coming from the landlord class, coming from East Ulster, which had an improved agriculture more on the Scottish lines, when he came to somewhere like Gidor, would have been, you know, very concerned to say, well, this is an archaic remnant. It's, you know, what we were in our childhood, as it were. Now we need to bring these into the mature state. We need to make Gidor more like Scotland, more like Hillsborough, more like Blessington, their southern estate. And, you know, he had absolutely no doubts, I think, that was the proper way to go, even if it meant severely and absolutely disrupting what was a very complex, intricate system which had been worked out to take advantage of the different resources of mountain, sea, and the little patch of good land along the coast in Gidor. And, you know, and once you disturb the ecology of a region like that, where everything is kind of very closely interconnected, you do it kind of serious damage. But I don't think that Hill and his sympathisers and the kind of PR machine that's behind, say, the famous Facts from Gidor pamphlet, which gets reprinted ad nauseum in the post-famine period, that none of them, I think, ever really understood why local people, you know, felt put out about this or why they resisted it. They just saw that as being one more symptom of their irredeemable barbarism.
When Hill published his facts, it was widely welcomed by the establishment. Glad to find a kindly landlord willing to invest in and develop his estate in the poverty-stricken west of Ireland. Not only did facts present Lord George's achievements in a flattering light, but presented a blueprint for unopposed change which paid. The political and administrative leaders of Britain were enthusiastic in trumpeting facts from Gwydor as a corrective remedy for other landlords and peasants suffering lack of investment and improvement in other parts of Ireland.
Facts from Gwydor set out in very clear terms the nature of the problem as a lot of commentators saw it in the 19th century, that this kind of business of rundale and micro-farming and the whole kind of, if you like, Celtic style of life, which included aspects of Irish language, Catholicism and so on, that was kind of an abomination for many people. And indeed, if you read Facts from Gwydor, then I think one of the most striking features in that book or pamphlet is the extent to which it is a case study of what needs to be done in the west of Ireland as a whole. Okay, and it becomes a kind of a little fable about what needs to, you know, what the impact of the famine will be. And I think one of the most staggering sentences in Facts from Gwydor is the cruel statement that the Irish people have profited much by the famine. Why have they profited from it? Because they have learned that overpopulation, rundale, these kind of wild Celtic habits won't do anymore, that they've learned a harsh lesson in the facts of life. You know, it's no accident that the book is called Facts from Gwydor, hard facts as opposed to the sentiment and the emotionalism and whatever of the Celts. You know, so that if you read Hill, like, he's viciously opposed to the idea, for example, that people should help one another. So, like, he's viciously opposed to what he calls the mendicants and the beggars, and the fact that people are giving them food and help. He's absolutely vicious about that. But the idea is that the, and again I quote, that the Irish are a people capable, when brought under salutary discipline, of performing all duties. You know, performing all duties. Again, the Victorian language. But what is the salutary discipline? You know, the salutary discipline is to learn to live under the thumb of a landlord. The salutary discipline is the discipline of the famine, which teaches you what happens when you overstep these kind of marks. And it's also couched in religious language. So he talks about the famine as being a divine providence, that the famine is actually a good thing because it's actually teaching these people the harsh facts of life. You know, and I think that's why it resonated, because it chimed in with the dominant attitudes in relation to the famine and whatever, which was that this would be a short-term pain for a long-term gain, and that it would accelerate the modernisation, in inverted commas, of the west of Ireland, which was extremely necessary, and shift Irish people from the old potato-based micro-farming culture into a more Scottish model, where you would get in the big sheep farms and so on. And that it chimes in very well with the dominant kind of moralism and providentialism of people like Charles Trevelyan and the key kind of famine administrators and post-famine administrators within Ireland.
The famous 3-month court case in the House of Commons in 1858 probably brought home to a lot of English people what was going on, because that was reported and they could read about it and so on. And it gives a very vivid and detailed account of what life was really like. So you can read that and then compare it with what Lord George Hill read. But you will notice there a great difference of culture, a difference of expression, a difference of attitude and so on. And that's where you get a glimpse of how involved and how deep the culture and attitudes went, and how difficult. That's why it was so difficult for George Hill to make much progress.
The recent readings of Hill's work and of the local landscape suggest that Facts from Gweedore was limited in many ways by the landlord's lack of understanding of the realities of peasant life on the Atlantic coast of Donegal. His critics hold that his own worldview blinded Hill and prevented him seeing the suitability of the Rundale system for a marginal area like Gweedore.
Large tracts in the interior are consequently neglected, lying waste from the population thronging the shore, where the land is subdivided into very small portions. The wretched system of Rundale being here in full force and operation, all this district of country is held under what is known by that term, and which may be thus described. In some instances, a tenant, having any part of a townland, no matter how small, had his proportion in 30 or 40 different places, and without fences between them, it being utterly impossible to have any, as the proportions were so very numerous and frequently so small that not more than half a stone of oats was required to sow one of such divisions. Thus, every tenant considers himself entitled to a portion of each various quality of land in his townland, and the man who had some good land at one extremity was sure to have some bad at the other, and a bit of middling in the centre, and bits of other quality in odd corners, each bounded by his neighbour's property, and without any fence or ditch between them. Under such circumstances as these, could anyone wonder at the desperation of a poor man who, having his inheritance in 32 different places, abandoned them in utter despair of ever being able to make them out? Fights, trespasses, confusion, disputes and assaults were the natural and unavoidable consequences of this system. These evils, in their various forms, were endless, and caused great loss of time and expense to the people attending petty sessions, and, of course, continued disunion amongst neighbours was perpetuated. As, on a certain day, all the cattle belonging to the townland were brought from the mountains and allowed to run indiscriminately over the arable land, and any that had not their potatoes dug or other crops off the ground were much injured. The benefit to the tenants was so very evident on that part of the estate where the Rundale system had been abolished, that those on that part of the property where it was still in force became pressing and even annoying to have their land divided in like manner, some of them even pleading with the agent that as they had paid their rent, they considered they had as good a right to have farms cut out for them as those who had already enjoyed the advantage.
The late Sean McGinley wrote the first history of his native parish, which was published as Scale Ridor in 1983. He offered two opposing readings of most of Hill's improvements.
There's a Norwegian Dolan Kindy and Tagushi Talwearta, an architect at heart. An architect Shaskasache, Groshe, he had Akri, Ure, Huihalo, Fes, Lean, Turnipi, Pretigas Mushende, a Tativellan Skilchen in it. Tesagun Link, Ger Hashishagas Grunchama, the Keren, Agas Horsa, Tayli Oga, Huniaru. I guess begging the Nikita Vartishan or hot sheaths, I guess in Ganyuan for Nisus and Trey, I guess Hunyatalu and Umas, a vascular and Keran, I guess in Fagro and the Shehid Akron, I guess in Fagra Jansha, Hunyatilu Kisal. You know, in well, carking the door review of a county, Avi Kin Milton, I one veg and Hunyan Minya Karki, Avi Mullen and for Hunyan Emmage, I guess in Mullen Union. Ah, well, Ahan to Garter. Kate of Adwell, Gur Erhinevich Smith of Fostamar, Villish and Tierna, and Chamanaku. Now, Tarodeller, while I'm Lord here, Shinon Ray Togu Beric with Retar, Shin 18 Talaberica Hokalt, I guess a toy Gertogan Beric on the hall beneath the good Kera Hassant, I guess an architect who gets a shark, Woy, the Molly Maguire's now a Munter of Fobul, with Milnat or Taru, Woy Chieton and Beric, I guess Fanamshin. Be O'Gayhead, could ye shayhead pace as the bubble gay door. Well, now, Vintaro, the Maruddig Master in the door, the rare and luring version of my country reduced, the Maruddig Master knew in Grihila, the gayhead, not a shayhead pace, or a late pace when you had vertebrae of football.
So he seemed a very reasonable man, and I think it's worth looking at the evidence given in 1858 in the House of Commons, where you will see the personality of the landlords coming through very strongly, and those that you wouldn't like to meet and those that you could probably come to some agreement with and so on. And they more or less split down the middle, half and half, and he's probably in the good half, if you like. George Hill may have attempted to understand what they were doing, but there was no way he was going to break through the huge barrier of language and culture. The fact that he did not have proper access to the Irish language, didn't probably speak or know the Irish language well, probably kept the other Ireland, as they call it, hidden from him in terms of culture and access and song and music and folklore. He would not have understood that type of Ireland anyhow. It would be most difficult for him. Had he learned Irish, I think, and acquired some knowledge of the culture, he probably would have understood in a better way why all the people who owned the land and the reorganization that he was trying to apply to the way the land had been divided and so on. I think he would probably have understood how that was attached not just to the land but to ways of doing things that were hundreds of years old, to superstitions, to folklore, if you like, to a cultural way of life, and why people didn't want to move from the kind of habitation which they had practiced, that is, living together and in the houses of groups of five or six and so on.
Not all of Hill's changes, I suppose, could be seen as being bad. I think that there were some good things that he proposed as well. But having said that, I think on the whole, I think he missed the point of what the system, the benefits of the system that were there, I suppose, either agriculturally in such bad land and also in socially and culturally, because if you look at the Clachan system, you'll find that the social setup was as important as anything else, insofar as that you had people who lived very much lechéile in terms of the mehel system. They worked together, they helped each other out. It was a very strong social system. And I suppose in trying to break it up, there was an attempt to break up the social system as well. And culturally as well, in terms of the closeness of the people in the clusters, and Erinyell, and the system of actually managing the land and managing the society was quite strong. And I think there was an attempt maybe to break that as well.
The people just didn't prove to be so easily malleable or whatever as he had thought. And what he also discovered was that simply changing, if you like, the shape of the chessboard where he could move around his little Gidor pawns or whatever, that it just didn't work like that, because these pawns kind of started moving of their own volition and whatever, and started doing things which he didn't like or whatever. And, you know, there's a famous book by an American historian called Weapons of the Weak, which talks about the way in which communities are able to subvert, even while seemingly being compliant, how they're able to subvert through petty or small little acts of insubordination, as it were. You know, moving kind of markers during the night, for example, or just small scale, low level, but routine kind of sapping of the whole kind of ground around it. And I think what you see in Gidor is very effective uses of these weapons of the weak, and that they're eventually actually able to reinstate, if you like, their own principles underneath this superficially massively changed landscape. So that what you get after 20 years, and this is, I think, what Hill eventually realises and why he throws up his hands in despair at it, what you get is, in fact, the old system re-emerging, and that what has happened is the power, the sophistication, the subtlety, the flexibility of the earlier culture has been able to actually undo everything that Hill has done, and they've done it, as it were, under his noses. And this is while he has been trumpeting to the world the wonderful achievements that he has done in Gidor.
It has been for a long time the most densely populated rural area in Western Europe, and people get very confused about how that happened, but it is, I suppose, a reflection on that tradition or that historical system, and how it really didn't break up in the way that the landlord had wanted it totally. I think he did have to compromise, because people wanted, even though in agreeing to go to individual strips of land or individual farms, the system that turned out was still a very striped ladder type farm system in most places, which still kind of gave you a little bit of good land and bad land. And then the houses were put very near each other as well. So it was an attempt, it became a kind of a linear cluster rather than a sort of a round or total cluster. But it was a sort of a reaction to it, I suppose, that the people says, well, okay, then if we have to go into these individual farms, we're still going to build the houses near each other.
What I think is most significant about Hill's attempted remodelling of the landscape is that it didn't work. The local people, who are then and now are very sophisticated in terms of finding ways around regulations that are inappropriate to their lifestyle and the region, the people just worked around it. And what you actually find is that, if you look at Gidor, say, in the 1860s or the 1880s or the baseline reports of the congested district board and whatever, what had happened is people had just worked around the system and reinstalled the older system. Now, it's operating in a slightly different template because of the striping and the reorganisation of the Rundale. But the Rundale principles, the Rundale philosophy, the older kind of cultural norms and practices have simply reasserted themselves, and people have very skillfully manipulated the Hill system to make it fit their needs, their prerogatives and whatever. And I think it's a brilliant example of the way in which you cannot just impose these kind of things from kind of outside. But what is striking is, in some respects, is that Gidor managed that maybe better than a lot of other communities, because elsewhere in the west of Ireland, where that kind of striping and so on happened, it did lead to a collapse of the local culture and to very massive kind of out-migration.
Lord George Hill had been born into the wealthy Downshire dynasty of Hillsborough Castle in County Down. His worldview was typical of his class and the Victorian era. While he loved and moved to live in Donegal, he failed to gain a full understanding of the complex cultural, social and environmental factors which had sustained community life in Gidor for generations before his arrival. Nevertheless, many feel that he did his best by his tenants and deserves to be seen as a saint among Irish landlords. The late E. Eston Evans of Queen's University Belfast wrote the foreword to a new edition of The Facts from Gidor in the 1980s. He was a strong supporter of Lord George Hill and the facts as presented on his behalf.
He was a well-meaning, if simple-minded man, bewildered by the opposition which his well-intentioned objectives encountered. In the end, he lost heart and gave up regular visits to Guido. The changes, for good or ill, brought about by Lord George Hill were completed by the Great Famine. In the new cultural landscape, enclosed fields and scattered homesteads took the place of the tangled Rundale holdings and clustered clachans. Isolation and self-seeking replaced the warmth and poetry of communal living. It's a friendly disorder, dear to the Irish heart. But if Lord George were to see it, he would want to start all over again to impose an English order on the scene. Whatever one may think of the Guido experiment, the fact remains that Lord George gave the world, in his Facts from Guido, the most detailed account that we have of the rural world of the Gael, of its cultural and physical attributes in the days before the Great Famine.
What it tells you about is Lord George Hill. I don't think it actually tells you very much about Guido at all. And the really interesting thing in that book is to understand the mentality, the attitudes, the motivation of a Lord George Hill. But it should never be presented, as it is, unfortunately, I think, in, you know, by people like Emer Eston Evans, as being somehow a very good account of, you know, the best account we have of Rundale and life in Guido and whatever. That's absolute patent nonsense. If you want to kind of approach that, go to the Irish language sources. Go to, say, collections made by Bohuki and various people up there. But don't pretend that this is some detailed, intimate account of life in Guido. It's not at all, in any sense, a kind of an intimate insider's view of life in Guido.
Na raukun to Guido and you, Jean, to in the years me kentje, as fast as a tower to get the Kendini, Gershonati, a die will not to hear, Lekama, Shilung, Dutch, Eston Evans, Gershonmar, which Katima has as Pata Pibber, Narokan to Nyahis Krakfall, Kentje, a Vikin to Shintanati, and Rutherford and Shinag will nish, Pinal the Clahan, you would a Gahanchaila, more on San Fuerk, add the show, Hatogodi for Hog, the make a good tea hand cheese and chin, I guess, really for your traditional go where I guess we shall have fire for item of mine now grow, you know, the clahan the chile, a toga, so grow clahan bugger hand chile, I guess, you're in. Congra da Clahanwig and Chile and the Gorsney. So it's Kinalda, it's Farbert and Chorus Rundale a thunder guy and Chorus Social to Akwell and Chorus Talia to catch it.